Hello, and welcome to episode 127 of Linux Dev Time. I'm Joe.
I'm Omelith.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Andy.
Good to talk to you all again. We've talked before about optimizing code, but recently, Kevin, you've been thinking about benchmarking.
Yeah, so there's a saying out there that says you shouldn't change something about your program unless you've measured it and you know which part of it is slow or what part to optimize. Like, you shouldn't go through that optimization portion of it. So there was a piece of code that we were working on that we thought needed to be optimized. So the first thing we do is we go to benchmark it. And it turns out writing benchmarks is notoriously hard. However, in the worst way, it's hard because it doesn't seem hard. And even the results make it seem like it wasn't hard at all. But you could be measuring the exact wrong thing. You could be measuring something you don't even know you're measuring. So benchmarking itself is super difficult.
Yeah, so I can think of a few possible ways it might be difficult. Was there a particular thing in this case that caught you out?
So in this case, if people that aren't familiar with how Rust does some optimization and benchmarking, you have various different benchmark frameworks and benchmark tools kind of built into the language and the tool chain natively, which is great. However, it's very possible for the optimizer, like the compiler itself, to optimize away the part that you're trying to measure. And you may not know it because your benchmark may come out saying it took 2 nanoseconds to run, which is surprisingly fast, but it's also not zero. So you may think, hey, it's optimized all the way down. What actually happens, and the only way you would know this is by either additional testing or looking at things like the low-level assembly and finding out, oh, it just took out the piece of code entirely because it determined that the piece of code that you were trying to run either was unnecessary because this is a artificial benchmark, it's not a real program, or because it could do the calculation ahead of time and figure out, oh, the answer is 42. So it would just spit out the answer at the end without doing any of the calculation. But unless you know to look like, hey, that's suspiciously fast or that's suspiciously low, you don't know whether or not you're actually measuring the thing that you want to be measuring. Or it's very hard to tell, rather.
Yeah, it kind of feels to me like benchmarking or performance measurement generally is like kind of like debugging, but harder even than that. You know, like it's so easy to accidentally focus on the wrong area or not have a clear chain of reasoning for why you're doing something. So you end up doing something that doesn't make any sense or anything like that. So just to be like clear what we're talking about, basically, when I say benchmarking, I mean writing a program that runs the thing that I'm worried might be slow a lot of times so that I can measure how long it takes. Is that what you're talking about, basically?
Exactly that, yes. And there are other cases related to that as well, where even if you just don't run the thing a lot of times, you can end up with very inaccurate results. There are tools out there that will do something like a warm-up phase because it turns out the way that your CPUs cache data and whether or not they're pulling from caches and the caches are quote-unquote warm or hot, like those can play differences in how long something takes to occur. So whether or not you did a warm-up phase, whether or not you've ran it multiple times, whether or not there's some sort of curve because you kind of want to get the averages, there all these things you have to consider when you're building that mini program to test the thing to see how fast it runs.
Yeah, and then you probably need a little bit of statistics to decide how many times I can run it before I can be sure that this is actually a consistent answer. It's not just random and all kinds of stuff like that as well.
Or that there's not noise because your CPU decided to try and do something different in the background, or you ran it on multiple different types of hardware. There's all kinds of considerations when you're talking about how can I run a benchmark, how can I make that benchmark repeatable, and how can I ensure that that benchmark is accurate.
Yeah, so I recently did some investigation into the performance of IndexedDB, which is a service that's offered by modern web browsers, which is basically like a database that's stored in the same place as the user of your browser, right? So it's not some kind of back-end database. It's right there in the browser. And you can store information there and then query it and get it out again. And our application is quite a kind of client-heavy thing, especially because all the cryptography happens, encryption happens in the on the client side because we can't trust the server. So we've got loads of stuff going on in that web browser. So we're using IndexedDB quite heavily for that. And we started seeing some weird performance problems. So I started going down the rabbit hole of how fast is this? Is it different between different browsers? And it quickly becomes clear that you have to be really clear what you're measuring. And in order to be clear what you're measuring, you have to be clear why you're measuring it. Because like if you measure something that kind of looks like it's the right kind of thing, but it's not actually the thing that you're really doing, then you end up with just confusing results that don't help you track down whatever performance problem you're tracking down.
Yeah, and an abstract example of this could be if you are wanting to optimize, let's say, some sort of calculation, and in your benchmark, you do something like load something from disk and then run the calculation and then exit, right? And you want to measure how long that takes. In this naive example, it might be apparent that, oh, the loading from disk is going to take a lot of time and will probably overshadow anything else in the benchmark. So it'll make it really hard to see, because that actual calculation that probably took nanoseconds or maybe slightly longer than that, and it will be really hard to pick out in any kind of a profile or profiler to see the actual part that you care about. You might just focus on the loading from disk part or something along those lines, right? There are so many other things to consider, like, is my process I/O bound? Is it a CPU bound task? Is it a network bound task? So there's all these weird things too that can go on to make it even hard to learn how to look at your problem.
When I think about benchmarks, I think about benchmarking hardware. And so you have standardized software for that, like FIO for disks and Passmark, let's say, for a CPU, and various networking benchmarking tools. But benchmarking software must be pretty hard, right? Because you can't have just one standard test for all the software. So you have to kind of write custom software to test your software. That must be a big problem.
And sometimes you even have to change your software to make it possible to benchmark in this way. Like, if the only way to test the thing currently involves loading something from disk, you have to rewrite it so you have some way to get to that piece of code without loading the thing from disk. Or your benchmark starts after you've loaded the thing from disk already, maybe.
Right, so you put a sleep to and in. Gotcha.
Yeah, I think there are some tools that help these days, like the Rust framework that Kevin was mentioning, and I think there are others in other setups that do things like the statistics. Like, they'll run it 10 times and they'll tell you what the standard deviation is or whatever, or tell you what the basically tell you whether you've run enough or you need to do 100 instead of 10. And also that they have like warm-up phases and things built in. So there's a bit of tooling around it. But yeah, fundamentally, the thing that you're actually benchmarking, you've got to somehow write the code that calls your code that you care about. And there's all kinds of pitfalls there, but about how you thought you cared about this bit of code, but actually it was a different bit that really makes it slow or whatever, stuff like that.
And usually in benchmarking, you have the benchmark tool itself spits out how long something took with some statistics. And compared to something like a profiler, which may run your code, but then just generate some either statistics or data about how your program ran in different parts of it and how long those took. So they're not necessarily statistics on like this piece of code ran this long. It might say this particular function ran this many times or took up this much of the total runtime. And you can use profiles to guide where you look into the program to later either do a benchmark or, you know, do some other further optimization. So there's two different ways to kind of look at program performance. And when you're talking about custom software in order to do the running, there's also multiple ways to go about that. There's things where you may be, like, for example, with the Rust built-in benchmarking kind of harnesses, you can a lot of times pull code directly from your actual application as if it were just a test. So you can call a function that may not even be publicly exposed and just that function. And that's the part that will get benchmarked. Sometimes that's not possible if you don't have some of that built-in tooling. So what you end up having to do is write a mini program that either copy and pastes or pulls in that other particular part that you want to test and just runs that small section as the program itself. And then there's a third option where you run the full program, but through some sort of configuration or arguments or whatever it is, you can narrow it down to just kind of the one thing that you want to test. And then there are tools that will run these mini programs for you, one of which is called Hyperfine, which is an excellent tool for doing this type of benchmarking where you want to run a program, run it many times, have some warm-ups, and get some statistics out of it about runtime. But you can use these tools to see, like, how long did it take to complete the runtime of that program? But then you have to do all the analysis later of, did I actually measure the thing that I thought I was measuring?
One aspect of this that I think is one of the subtleties that can make it more complicated than it seems is that often what you're actually thinking about is how does this scale or how does this change under certain other conditions. The examples that I'm thinking of are lots of people in, say, in a web application, they want to know what the 99th percentile performance is, which basically means I want to know what the rare bad case is and I want to make that as rare as possible. Or I know that the kind of normal performance is fine, but I don't want any one user to suddenly get a really bad experience. So that's one example of a, like, there's a distribution. So it's the shape of the distribution that you care about there, not just the average. But the other example I was thinking of is in this IndexedDB stuff, I was really interested in how big can we make our database or what size of object can we put in our database? And with that kind of problem, it won't just go up in a straight line. Like, you know, it takes five times longer to make a five times bigger object. What's going to happen is there's going to be some kind of catastrophic point where it's too big and suddenly it's really slow. So you're interested in like the shape of the curve, not just like a single number.
And sometimes you're also interested not just in like runtime performance, so like how long did something take. Sometimes you're interested in the other aspects of it, like how much memory did it take? You know, what was the memory pressure? What was the cache utilization like? Was I actually hitting the cache or was I constantly missing the cache? And in those cases where you're missing the cache, all that's saying is it went through the cache, the data that it wanted was not there, and it had to go up to the next level, until eventually it has to reach out to main memory. And all of those quote-unquote cache misses are opportunities where something could have potentially been faster had that data been there already, but for some reason that data was no longer in cache and got ejected, and then you have to find out, why was that? Can I do this in an order or in a method or way that I can constantly hit the cache and get a cache hit, as in the data is in the cache that I wanted?
We've done a lot of discussing like why it's difficult. So all of this leads me to like think like, when should I use benchmarking and when should I just not? Or I feel like the places where I've seen it being useful, I think the most useful is we know something's prone to become slow and we've made it all right. So then I would just add in a test saying this must take no more than 5 minutes. And if it takes over 5 minutes, I know that I've done the mistake I always make and made it slow again, so that this will warn me that something's gone wrong. So that kind of like canary test, I guess, of like our performance is degraded.
Yeah, so while benchmarking is difficult to do right, I've actually found it useful in many different scenarios to get as close as possible or give you a rough idea. So long as you don't take that benchmark as gospel and say that this is exactly how the thing is running and this is how fast, quote unquote, my thing is. Because usually how fast something is really only matters relative to a bunch of other data, like relative to other hardware, relative to other software, relative to something else. Knowing just how long something takes is not in and of itself that useful. But comparing that what am I comparing it to could just be the software itself. So similar to Andy's example, if you have benchmarks running in CI, you can say, was there a slowdown due to this merge request? Did it make things happen an order of magnitude slower than it did before? Those types of benchmarks are very, very handy, and they're kind of high level. They're not super accurate, but they give you a good warning sign that there might be something you want to look at. Now, the caveat of that is you have to ensure that these benchmarks are run in a repeatable and deterministic fashion. So NCI is usually a terrible, terrible place to do it.
Not on GitHub runners, yeah.
Exactly. You're running in a shared workspace, hardware that may change out under you. You have no idea what the load is on the rest of the actual host. There's all kinds of problems. If the runners get upgraded or you use a different OS just because you changed your CI, all kinds of things can make your benchmark all of a sudden report that it is now like 50% faster or 50% slower when nothing changed at all. So you have to be very careful with those types as well.
So you're saying you should only really be doing these kind of benchmarks on hardware that you control?
Ideally.
Ideally, and those are the ones that you should be putting more faith in. It's not saying you can't run a benchmark on hardware you don't control or NCI. It's just saying that you have to take that data with a large pinch of salt.
And I would say, basically, my experience is just don't do it on GitHub runners specifically, right? Because they are so variable in their performance.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by people who support us with PayPal and Patreon. Go to linuxdevtime.com/support for details of how you can support us too. Patreon supporters have the option to listen to episodes without ads like this. And it's not just this show. There's Late Night Linux for news, discoveries, audience input, and misanthropy. 2.5 admins about system administration. Linux Matters for upbeat, family-friendly adventures. Linux After Dark for silly challenges and philosophical debates. Hybrid Cloud Show for everything private and public cloud. And Ask the Hosts for off-topic questions from you. You can even get some episodes a bit early. We've got a lot going on, and it's only possible because of the people who support us. So if you like what we do and can afford it, it would be great if you could support us too at linuxdevtime.com/support.
The other style of benchmark that I've also found useful is if I've basically already figured out something, I've figured out that this way is slow for this reason, and I just want to kind of prove it or like check that I'm really right about it. At that point, I'll do quite a low level benchmark of just this piece of functionality, really focused, and then prove to myself or someone else that this is worth making this change because it doesn't make a difference.
Those changes that don't make a difference are really interesting to me because there's a lot of cases where you might see a piece of code and you say, oh, I'm doing this really inefficiently. I could hoist this part out of a loop, or I could, you know, not dereference a pointer here. There's all kinds of things I could be doing much faster. So you change the code. And if you do have benchmarks set up and you try to run that small micro benchmark, you may find out that you just made your code slower. So if you make those changes in a vacuum without verifying also that not only, this is a good part about like the benchmark measuring. Not only do you need to know what your baseline is, but you need to know, like, did my change make a difference? So sometimes it's not just, is my code fast or slow? It's, I want to have a baseline metric for future changes.
Yeah, often when you're writing code these days for a modern compiler, you're better off basically trying to be as clear as possible to the compiler what you're trying to do, rather than trying to second guess the compiler and say, oh, you should organize the memory in this way, because generally the compiler knows a lot better than you.
But also being clear with the compiler what you're not trying to do accidentally is almost as key. Where, for example, let's say you have a variable that is listed as mutable, but you do something with the variable and you no longer need to mutate it. If you can't tell the compiler, hey, this thing is no longer mutable, I don't need to mutate it anymore, then the compiler, even though you don't mutate it anymore, might have to assume that it is mutable or that it aliases in some way. And therefore, it will skip optimizations and not do something. Not because you didn't tell it exactly what you're trying to do. The code says what you're trying to do, and it could be very clear. But some compilers may not be able to do that sort of analysis to say, like, oh, this thing actually never mutates again. Ergo, I can make some optimizations based on that assumption.
So then another good way of using benchmarks is if you're looking at some code and thinking, I can't understand this. I think I should restructure it, but I know that technically that restructuring is going to make it do something that looks a bit slower to me. If you can then just use a benchmark to show the difference is trivial or it doesn't actually make a difference at all, that means you then have permission to make your code easier to understand.
I would also say with some benchmarks, they're a really good target for learning how to use things like a profiler. And because they are small, contained programs, usually with some sort of performance characteristic that you want to measure or see. So running a profiler against these types of things or programs that you want to benchmark is a really good way to learn those tools, because those tools can be very, very complex. And learning to read things like a flame graph or like jump through different call stacks to figure out which ones actually matter and, you know, what you're looking at, what is noise and what is not noise, that can all be very difficult and kind of a daunting task to learn. So using a profiler, and there are many, many, many ones out there, but using those on these kind of small contained programs, especially when you're measuring little like micro changes, can be beneficial and helpful because you can see those changes on a graph or like visually.
The most optimization work I think I've done is using a flame graph to identify particular portions of my code that are running slower than I would think they should be. What other mechanisms or tools are there to find those kinds of issues?
It depends what exactly you're trying to see. A flame graph or some kind of a profiler that lets you see that style of data, those are really good. And a flame graph, what it is another program that will run alongside your program and snapshot more or less the view of that program as it runs. And it will calculate things like the call stack, the amount of memory used, and it will do this many, many times a second. And you can usually set how often that interrupt is. And then it will show you in a what looks kind of like a flame, because the more a function is called, it'll show the full call stack. So function A called function B, which called function C. And as you can imagine, like these little functions stacking on top of each other. And then as function C ends, it goes back down to B, and function B ends, goes back down to A. It kind of looks like a flame.
The call stack is shown vertically and time is shown horizontally.
Yes. And what it allows you to see is kind of which functions are called a lot, like which ones take up a lot of the horizontal time, as well as kind of how deep a call stack is and how vertical they are. So those are super beneficial, but sometimes those can be a little bit misleading, because if a function is called and it might be an important function, but is not running while the quote unquote snapshot happens, you may get a misrepresentation for what your actual profile looks like. And some profilers can also link these back to like the source code. There are other tools out there too, like CacheGrind and ValGrind and other ones that will tell you like how often you are getting a cache miss, or how often you're getting a cache hit. So there are things like that that you can look at. And I've even seen people use what I guess you could call a poor man's profiler or flame graph, which is just sort of a printf debugging where you're counting the number of function calls, which is funny and sometimes it works.
Yeah, always printf. Yeah, I think definitely mixing up the tools is useful, because often in order to actually get to the truth, you have to get past something that's kind of fooling you. So like there might be one function that's taking up all of the runtime, but actually that function is like super fast. Like maybe it's in the standard library and it does its job very well. But the problem really is that you're calling it too many times. So what you need is to find out who's calling it and why. And so the number of function calls can be helpful. And then often also performance problems come from using too much memory. So then something that shows you how much memory is getting used for different operations, it's a much better way to get to the truth of what's going on.
Almost anything that interacts with memory is going to equate to quote unquote slowdowns. Now, that's not exactly true, but the more memory you use, the slower something is going to be in the general sense. And by memory use, I mean more along the lines of lots of allocations, lots of deallocations.
Yeah.
That's why you'll see people say like, oh, if we just allocate one giant object at the beginning and use that kind of like a slab, or, you know, places where we can put things that never really die off, you'll actually end up with way better runtime performance, because you're not doing all of these like super tiny, super fast, but ultimately add up memory allocations and deallocations over and over and over.
I must have told you the story of how I spent 6 months of my life trying to improve the performance of a C++ application that essentially, under the covers, all it did was copy strings from one type of string representation to another, because we had three different ones. So yeah, shifting memory around, especially small chunks of memory, and finding where to put it is often the problem.
There's one other funny aspect of benchmarking or optimization, where sometimes the program that you write or the way that you write your benchmark, because it's slightly different, can affect the benchmark itself. For example, one of the kind of funny cases that I've run into before is if you are doing any sort of like multi-threaded programming or doing anything with locks, and then you do something that has to also do some output. Let's say, for example, like print a standard out for some reason. You're printing a statistic or something. That locking of standard out that happens can be enough to entirely change the performance profile of the program, because before there was no locking, so nothing ever really paused. It never had time to, so things can end up colliding or there can be whatever weird issue. But because this test program took a lock on standard out, that was just enough time for everything to kind of sort itself out and be fine for the benchmark that ultimately did not portray anything about the actual code.
I feel like the key message of this episode has got to be, you probably shouldn't be benchmarking it, because you're probably benchmarking the wrong thing, because almost certainly your problem is one extra network connection, which is like 10,000 times more time than like all of this stuff we've been talking about.
Yeah, what I'm taking away from this is you shouldn't be chasing tiny optimizations to improve benchmarks a tiny bit here and there. Maybe zoom out a little bit.
Absolutely. There's some micro optimization, like the language benchmark games, where you'll see the languages get ranked in some sort of artificial benchmark, and people will spend a lot of time optimizing those. And it's funny because those are very, very rarely equivalent to real world performance. You could have something that's like number 20 on the list of these micro benchmarks that in the real world for 99.999% of cases actually outperforms some of the other cases because the real world is very different from these like micro benchmarks that are testing one very, very small, very specific thing.
But by the way, if this all this conversation has whetted your appetite about like fetishizing super high performance micro benchmarking stuff, there's a couple of excellent blog posts by the author of RipGrep, which is a file searching program.
It's a very good one.
Yeah, one of his blog posts talks about the regular expression engine, and one talks about the all the stuff around it that actually accesses files and stuff like that. And the optimization that's gone into that program is unbelievable. The level of expertise is incredible. And measuring all that stuff, and again, it is at a more zoomed out level that you need to measure that. Otherwise, you're totally going to miss the fact that actually it's some weird subtlety of like the Linux file system that makes this faster than doing it the other way or whatever.
So far, I think everything we've talked about has been manual. Like a human looks at the profile and a human decides what code changes need to be made and whatnot. But I know Go at least has this mechanism. I think it's called profile guided optimizations, where you run your application ideally in production with the real workload, and you obtain a profile of the performance over a long period of time. Then you feed that profile into the optimization system, and it just magically makes your code better. Not really.
Yeah, profile guided optimization or PGO is very cool. Rust has it as well. It's one thing that I think you have to be a little bit careful with, because you have to have a use case to get that profile in order to guide the optimization. So what's happening without that is your compiler is making its best guess about what the use case will be, or based off of the code, and optimizing based off of that. But there might be certain assumptions that are incorrect, like how often a function is called. Maybe a function is called a million times, and it turns out like inlining it would have been way better than leaving it as its own function. But the compiler doesn't know how often something is called. So in those cases, letting a program run for a long time and getting that profile that the optimizer, like the actual compiler, can look at and say like, oh, okay, now I actually know how this program was used. I can make these specific optimizations to this use case. That can really, really help. But you have to realize that it will really help for those use cases that it was tested in. And if you're doing it in some other way, then that optimization may actually be a slowdown for your particular use case.
So in particular, you should never get the profile by running your benchmark and then feed that into the optimizer, because your benchmark is very much not your normal program usage.
Absolutely. That's a super great call out. And this is also why JIT compilers can sometimes outperform ahead of time compiled programs, because the JIT compiler is watching the program run live and saying like, oh, this piece of code is run an awful lot and it's run in this way. I can optimize it by doing this. And it does a little small optimization and then, you know, continues to run the code. That's why those can end up outperforming ahead of time compiled sometimes.
Yeah. And profile guided optimization is basically static language people being jealous of some of the very rare occasions where JIT languages go faster and thinking, we can't have this.
And the optimization doesn't actually change the source code, right? It just does stuff in the compiled binary.
Yeah, it guides the optimizer on what the best way is to compile your source code into machine code.
So it's an additional thing in the existing optimization process of the compiler.
Yeah.
I believe there are some write-ups on how Rust uses it, because what the compiler team will do is run the PGO pipeline across the top X number of crates. They're compiling real world crates to get these profiles that they can then feed back into the compiler that they release out to everybody. So they have some interesting write-ups. I'll have to see if I can find those.
That's a good example. The Rust compiler people have access to a lot of real world examples, because there's a ton of open source Rust code out there. If their job is just to compile it, then they've got the data that right there of how long it takes to compile it.
Right, well, we'd better get out of here then. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, but until then, I've been Joe.
I've been Omelith.
I've been Kevin.
And I've been Andy.
See you later.